Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Hi, and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and I'm the regular host of the show, as well as the founder of the UK charity of the same name, Yes to Life. The show's just one of the things the charity does to fulfil its mission of supporting and informing people with cancer about the many benefits of integrative medicine. My guest on the show today is a distinguished oncologist who works at Worcester Oncology Centre at NHS Worcester Royal Hospital. Dr. Cheng Boon specialises in the non-surgical management of head and neck cancers, upper GI tract and other selected uses of radiotherapy and chemotherapy for particular cancers. Additionally, he's medical director of OncoDNA, a gene testing company, and he has a particular interest in the potential of genetic data to drive personalisation and to improve outcomes. I'm talking to Dr. Boon over the internet. Cheng, a big welcome to the Yes to Life show.
Hello, good afternoon, Robin. Yeah, hope you're well.
Thanks so much for being willing to come on the show and speak about your work. So one of the major bugbears to conventional oncology has always been that a treatment protocol that's hugely successful for one patient can be an outright disaster for another one, with results anything from ineffective to actually life-threatening. So would it be fair to characterise the thrust of your work as being to match patients with the treatments that genuinely hold the most promise for them specifically?
Thank you, Robin. That concept of using generic chemotherapy for cancers that arise from any anatomical structures, that has always been how oncology has been done for many decades. And that era where we have thousands of patients entering into large trials and using generic chemotherapy in whichever combination to try and keep some benefit on average is very hard to replicate, because at the present moment, we have the technology potentially to sequence not just the cancer itself, but actually the patient. So potentially in future, where sequencing technology will be cheap enough, we could actually make a prediction on what chemotherapy we could offer the chemotherapy to the certain patient with a certain mutation. And we can also avoid certain chemotherapy that some patients may be particularly susceptible or more toxic to. We have only just started doing that with, for example, the DPYD testing for any patients being offered fluoropyrimidine chemotherapy at the present moment. So the era for changing treatment to what we call personalized medicine is just beyond the horizon, but the limitation at the present moment is oncology is still very much rules-based. We have to follow what the data has shown us. The data, unfortunately, over the past few decades is to use conventional multi-agent chemotherapy agents. It is about changing the whole oncology world, how we view things, and it will come.
It is a very different mindset. Well, thanks for setting it out so clearly. There's these two very important sides to it you spoke about there. One of them is the cancer that you have and how effective the chemotherapy you're considering will be with that cancer, which is part of the picture. But you also are saying that the other side is that the genetic code can show us whether that particular chemotherapy is going to be okay for that person or whether it could be very damaging to them. Both of those are very important pieces of information, aren't they?
So what I tend to explain to my patient, to simplify it, and this comes from comics books. So you have a sword, you have the shield.
Yep.
The sword is what we use to attack the cancer, and you need to have the right sword to slice through the right cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So if your chemotherapy agent or whichever anti-case cancer agent, and you're trying to use it to cut through, and the cancer is resistant, then there's no point trying to use a blunt sword to attack something. On the other hand, the shield is to protect the patient from your sword. So is chemotherapy, as you know, is a double-edged sword. What you slice through, you also harm the patient. So it is a fine balance as an oncologist that we are every day putting patients through potentially toxic treatment.
Yes.
And yet we have to do it in order to get some result. And it is finding the balance, particularly with the ever-changing risk that patients undergo in the overall health service and in the overall world, the data that we have are decades old, but the threats that we face on a daily basis changes depending on what virus blows in through the wind. So it is quite difficult to give you a firm answer to that.
Yeah. It's interesting. So in a way, you could say that the original cancer treatments were a very blunt instrument, which was used indiscriminately. But those same blunt instruments can be actually be a lot safer with genetic testing, and they can be also a lot more effective. So whereas the aim is obviously to try and find a treatment for cancer that doesn't do in the patient, that would be far preferable. But while we're relying on these kind of toxic agents, the best we can do is to make sure we don't do any damage and that we do something useful with them.
We agree on that. And many of the latest trials, particularly in the last 5 years, have gone away from increasing the dose or the intensity of the chemotherapy. We used to think more is more. We keep pushing, you know, patients having more chemo. Two chemo is not enough, put three chemo in, and then we try four. And we realize we've reached the wall. The patient's physical condition cannot cope with more chemo.
Right. So
what the last 5 to 10 years have been spent on earlier diagnosis, but we're faced with the problem of aging patients. Now, patients who are older, who have more medical problems, I'm not being ageist per se, but what I'm saying is you have more risk factors, what we call comorbidities.
Yes.
And it is the same whether you have COVID or chemotherapy. The more risk factor you have, the higher your age, and obviously the less your reserve. And this doesn't apply to 100% of all patients. We have some very fit 90-year-olds who should be offered chemotherapy, even combination chemotherapy. But overall, we need to have a better way of selecting this group of patients. Just like the surgeons, they would have the anesthetists doing their exercise stress test, put them on the wheel and put them on the exercise, see how they cope with their breathing, whether they would tolerate the surgery before saying no to them. We need to think very carefully as oncologists as we treat older and more frail patients, but also with the world with rife with infections, we need to have a way of actually checking their immune system. Can you tolerate even a little bit of stress to your system?
Yeah.
It's getting harder, but we're getting more advanced in that, and the technology exists nowadays. You know, there's Fitbits. It would be an ideal way of testing people. You put them on, you measure them, you put them through their daily paces, you get them to, you know, exercise, do stress. It's being implemented routinely because we're all focused on one thing. Oncologists are good at giving chemotherapy. We're good at what we know with how to target cancers. But actually, if we take one step back and select the right patients, it makes our job much easier. And it all requires joined-up thinking, whether working with anesthetists, working with other clinicians, working with technology companies, with patients and you know, using the latest cutting-edge technology to make life better for patients and also more importantly for my life, because I don't like to give highly toxic chemotherapy and make my patients poorly.
No, right.
It's not what we are in here to do.
No, absolutely. I imagine one of the sort of frustrating things is that there's a cost attached to gene sequencing, but actually in relation to a lot of modern cancer treatments, it's actually cheap as chips. Isn't that true?
Well, as oncologists, I try to avoid the issue of cost. But in reality, as oncologists, it's always there. The elephant is in the room.
Yeah.
The cost of developing a new drug is no longer in the tens of millions. Now the drug companies are saying it costs $100 million to come up with a brand new drug. And once you have it, you have a 10-year patent, and you want to make as much as you can while you have the patent on it.
Yeah.
So the concept of immunotherapy, well, the drug companies ideally would want us to use it for every cancer in every stage all the time.
Of course.
And obviously in any healthcare system that depends whether on self-funding or taxation or general payer, you can't afford that. You have to have a way of selecting. As oncologists, sometimes we feel uncomfortable talking about cost. Essentially, we are sort of gatekeepers. What the role of GPs used to be to limit cost to the overall system, and it's hard. Fortunately, working in the NHS, there are still certain rules we have to follow. Like the NICE guidance would limit what we can use. Cancer Drug Fund allows English patients to have a little bit more compared to other countries in the UK. That's something that is political, and I have no control over that. You just have to know your patients and where you work. And then it becomes more difficult once the patients say, well, I'm willing to self-fund it, then it becomes a question for individuals to consider if, you know, they want to spend that amount of time and money for a very small or marginal potential benefit, because we have no way of selecting who we should offer this.
Mm.
So when you compare that and having something like a genomic test, which could range from, let's say, 5,000 or 6,000 for top of the line, I wouldn't mention the brand, to something more than 1,000 if you do a smaller panel, then in the overall scheme of things, this is less than 1% of the cost of, you know, immunotherapy, if you really want to go down that path. So I would say this is useful for not just insurers, for patients, but also in future, the governments and national bodies, because they will start to see, well, hang on, if we empower our oncologists and we say, look, we trust you to make your judgment, but please use the best technology to do it, I suspect we would be able to cut the cost anyways. Most of these tests will tell the patients not to use a drug rather than to say use expensive drugs.
Right. It seems to me pretty well, I put money on the fact that if you actually routinely did this testing, you'd save money, because you'd think of the amount of wasted treatments you wouldn't do that you knew weren't going to work for a start. So, and then think of reduced cost of a successful treatment as opposed to a treatment that didn't work, and then you have a very poorly patient afterward who has to be looked after. It seems to me complete sense as a money-saving exercise.
So the main difficulty we have is to get that kind of level of evidence for what the taxpayers, what the NICE committee will accept. So at the present moment, what they are asking for is what we call, you know, phase three data, or maybe multiple phase three trials, which, to be frank, has not been done yet, because diagnostics, like you say, is only the fraction of the cost. The drug companies that makes billions, obviously, it's not in their interest to do this kind of test for everyone.
No.
So you're going up against difficult questions, whether we, you know, encourage this kind of test more, then the question becomes who will fund for it. Second thing is, as the cost of doing this genomic testing comes down, I suspect it will be routinely done anyways, and then we will have the problem of every hospital or every cancer center trying to do their own panels, and then we have the issue of how do we standardize the findings and how do we interpret them, and we make sure that all the oncologists at least have sort of an agreement that this is how we interpret it, and this is how we do the test, and this is how we agree on to all accept the results. We are at the cutting or the bleeding edge of technology here. We're doing NGS, we're doing advanced technology. But if we don't start the conversation, then we do a disservice to the patient, because if they go online, they go onto the United States panel, you'll see it. If you go to even India, where they have a homegrown NGS technology companies, they have small panels. They do a certain number of genes, maybe up to 10, maybe up to 100.
Yeah,
they do some of the tissue tests, and they are already using it, because, as you can imagine, India is the size of Western Europe. In fact, the size of the whole of Europe.
Yes,
and is divided into very wealthy capital cities where the wealth inequality is much greater than Western world. What happens is that the tests are already being routinely done in the larger tertiary centers. And they found that actually the oncologists there also faced with the same problem. It's not that they can't do it. It's whether everybody will agree to do it and interpret it in the same way. NHS has a technology. They do have a body. It's called Genomics England. And I think they are working towards this. But the level of evidence that Genomics England and NHS England wants would require a number of years and also a sort of a typical study type of environment to validate it. Now, I'm not sure whether, you know, we have the capacity or the funding to run this kind of trials. For example, initially in about 4 or 5 years ago, one of the genomics NGS companies submitted a application to NICE to see if we could validate and use this test routinely on all patients. One of the problem was they were not arguing that actually using this test would be cheap. What they were saying is that we should use this test and look for mutation and sort of change treatment. So they were looking for what I would call the SWOT approach, whereupon they forgot the SHIELD approach. To cut costs, to stop using drugs that are not effective. So if you just use the SWOT approach, you can never win, because the technology is always backward looking. Where from the drug companies always, 5 to 10 year horizon down the line, they will not release their drugs all at once. They would have to validate it, get phase 2, phase 3 trials done. They will have to show that it's safe, then come to market. So the technology is constantly evolving. I'm not sure how we're going to design or run this kind of clinical trials. And also the problem with personalized medicine is you do require the patients to have physical reserve. You need to be fit enough. You need to be motivated to really push yourself down to this path, because not all cancer centers will have access to all these experimental drugs where you're looking for a certain mutation. If you do find it, then the question becomes, can I get access to drugs? So it's hard. It raises difficult ethical questions.
So you're saying that the kind of public access to it could be way down the road in terms of getting the evidence. But if you just decide to go out and say, well, actually, £1,000, £2,000 to save my life, it's not that much, I'll spend the money. But you might find out some information you can't act on because you can't actually get access to the treatments that are shown to be the correct ones for you.
So that is one of the hazards of doing this kind of thing routinely. But the way to mitigate that is you do need to read around your tumor site. So as oncologists, particularly in the UK, we specialize in 1, 2, maybe 3 tumor sites, and we become very good and experienced and confident in the drugs, particularly in the sequence of drugs that we're going to offer patients.
Right.
Going down the genomics pathway, we have to sort of ignore where the cancer arose from. So it doesn't matter whether you have colon cancer or brain cancer or lung cancer, you sort of go back down to the basics. You know, have you got certain mutation? And if that mutation was tested in, let's say, for example, a different tumor site, let's say breast cancer or lung cancer, can you use it in colon cancer? And whether the drug company, if you write to them, will they allow you either access to a trial, or whether they will allow you access to what we call compassionate access program, which means the drug company will give you the drug at a certain price or a certain cost, but at the price that they will say, you know, there's no licensing, there's no evidence because we haven't tested it on. So it does raise the worry by oncologists that you're going down a path that has limited evidence. You don't really have a lot of evidence for this use. And this is particularly a problem in cancers with less numbers in the Western world.
Yeah.
So the common cancers would have less problem, like prostate cancer, you have lots of prostate patients. Breast cancer, you have many patients. Lung cancer, there are many mutations throughout the world. But let's say, for example, if you have a rare small bowel cancer or a rare abnormal tumor types, then you would struggle.
Yeah. Okay, I see that. And basically, I think you're just saying that the system isn't really set up to support personalization the way you're talking about. It's just fundamentally built in a different way. And therefore, once you start trying to do it, you're immediately sort of off-piste and you're on your own. So, it's a very difficult change to make because it's such a radically different way of looking at health.
So we know that because the genomics company that originally attempted to run this commercially in the UK have mostly withdrawn from the market. So I work for a company called OncoDNA, and they've also recognized this problem. So what the mission or the idea behind it is to work together with oncologists, with clinical trials unit, with industry, with pharmaceuticals, with compassionate use centers, with NHS Trust, we do have to work together. All of us have to accept that if we go down the path of genomics, personalized medicine, we have to change our way of thinking, first of all, before you even change practice.
Right.
We have to accept that, you know, sometimes, yes, we can accept where the tumor is coming from and follow the rules, but we have to think, when do we vary from it? When do we look for the mutation? And if we find a mutation, how do we address this? And the NHS also has a solution. They have a genomics MDT, which are being done in the 7 genomics hub in the UK, as far as I know. I'm not part of the genomics hub, but I'm not too sure how to get in those hubs. They have not actively invited, many oncologists to be in. So even in the NHS, they are all working in silos. And I find that is the biggest challenge. As long as you break the silos down, we talk to the lab, we talk to the pharmaceutical, we talk to people who make the drug, we talk to the lab scientists who invent the test, and all of us pulling together, will probably improve the patient's outcome.
Right, very interesting. So look, you just mentioned that you work for a company called OncoDNA. You're their medical director. I think that's a fairly recent appointment of yours. Do you want to tell us how you've made this journey from the wards, you know, being an oncologist, to being medical director of a gene testing company?
So I'm still a practicing oncologist. Okay, I originally met their representative in the UK, and it's Amanda. And I met her in a medical conference several years ago. She was working for a different company. It appears that she subsequently worked for OncoDNA, and OncoDNA was faced with a problem of having a product, knowing the product works and is being used clinically in the rest of the world,
right,
and yet faced with the problem with the UK uptake is less than ideal. It's not easy to enter the market for the challenges which I've already outlined. So Amanda is forward-thinking in trying to put all this together to try and get oncologists interested, to try and get busy oncologists to try and, you know, change their mind and their worldview. And that's how I got involved, because I treat fairly difficult to treat cancer. I treat upper GI cancers with patients who have advanced cancers with limited numbers of treatment options and also very poor prognosis. The average survival for stomach cancer or esophagus cancer, stage 4 or advanced stage 3, is less than a year. So I don't really have many chemotherapy options. So when you start looking for clinical trials, you end up asking, do you have a certain mutation? And by the time they have used up their chemo, they are too poorly or too frail to try and re-biopsy them and try and chase for more mutations. So that's how we started the conversation. It became, you know, how do we help oncologists? And it became how they can help me. So my involvement with them has taught me that actually, if we look for the mutation slightly earlier in the pathway, just, you know, initially, particularly right, in cancers with limited prognosis, you have a higher chance of actually going into a clinical study or looking for drugs.
Mm.
And that's how the conversation continued. And I am offering my service to help sort of be an oncologist whisperer, to understand
right,
what pressures we are faced with, and also to make the company understand, you know, is, yes, you can disrupt an industry, but you're not just disrupting oncologists' work, but you have to change the whole healthcare system, how it is provisioned, how you diagnose people, how you do tests, and how you actually get funding for treatments.
Wow. It's interesting. In a certain kind of way, it feels like you're up against the same thing. You know, obviously, I'm working, talking about integrative medicine all the time. So this is, again, integrative medicine could be described as person-centered medicine, which is something that the NHS has been talking about for a long time, but not really progressing very fast with. And the change, the difference, if you like, in progress between the American healthcare model, which we don't particularly like over here, and our one,
yep,
is that we are more than a decade behind. And it sounds like it's exactly the same in the territory you're talking about, and probably for the same reasons, which is that, you know, the healthcare service here, because it's one thing, it's not a group of competitive businesses who are looking to do the best and latest thing that their customers will be keen to buy, is actually able to resist change in an extraordinary way. It just says, well, we're not changing and nobody can do anything about it. And it's quite frustrating because, whereas there are other marvellous features of the NHS which everybody loves, this is actually it's kind of the bad side of it, that we're very far behind now.
So it comes back to philosophy of the founding of NHS. When you ask, you know, the original founders of NHS, what is it meant to be?
Right.
It was meant to give people, you know, emergency treatment,
yes,
for, you know, life-threatening diseases. It was not meant to offer, you know, personalized medicine, you know, targeted treatment, because it's meant to be one size fits all. If
yeah,
you have an accident, you go to A&E, they fix you, off you go. It doesn't mean that you go in, you know, you fix your toe and then you have a slightly different angle. It becomes all-encompassing. NHS has expanded and expanded and expanded,
right,
and expanded because what people want it to be. So if you compare what it was originally invented for and what it is doing now, is no longer, you know, just one thing.
No,
and I obviously I'm biased. I work for the NHS as well. It's It's very hard. I find it difficult because it's funded by taxation. If you want to do everything for everyone, then you come back to the philosophy is the taxpayer prepared to accept that? Is the treasury prepared to accept that? And it becomes political very quickly. It becomes, why should I pay my taxes to fund for somebody's, you know, bariatric surgery or whatever treatment that people feel that is of low value? And that's one of the criteria they use, value. But when you are the patient having cancer, what is value when you have, you know, an advanced cancer? Money makes no difference anymore. You could be a billionaire, and yet money has no meaning because you couldn't buy time. So it is hard. There is no one way of looking at it. It's about what
Well, I was saying that the NHS is exceptional in some ways, and it is actually exceptional in just the way you said. If you look at what it was set out to be in, you know, the last century, it does that incredibly well, I think. I mean, you know, emergency medicine, it can't be faulted on. And we're all enormously grateful for that. But this is a problem area. You're absolutely right. Okay, so I thought it would be quite interesting if we just trace for our listeners the journey that science has been on in exploring the human genome. I think it's kind of a very interesting story that so far, I think it's delivered some really different answers to the ones that they thought they were going to get when they set off. Do you want to just say, you know, what has happened in the course of the last few decades in terms of the development of the science behind genomics?
So we can go back a bit longer than that. We can say, you know, initially, diabetes, before we invented insulin, was a death sentence. If you have diabetes without insulin, you wouldn't live very long. And then somebody found that the insulin could be taken from dogs. They took pancreas. And it was one of their first, you know, personalized medicine. You find a problem, you can find a replacement, you kept the patient alive, you kept them going. Mm. And so that was the first one, I would say, targeted treatment, insulin. But as we move further along the line, we know that chemotherapy works. And that came from the war when people were using poison gas, mustard gas, and noticed their white cells were falling. And actually, it's a very good cell killer. It targets the DNA. Chemotherapy is excellent at doing that. The problem is, obviously, it's a double-edged sword. It kills the good cells as well. And then we move on to newer technology as we discover that the double helix, you know, and start thinking to sequence it. That was over the turn of the millennium where, you know, were you all using landlines before the era of, you know, iPhones and things were much easier. You know, oncologists don't have to think about mutation. We just give based on what tumor you had cancer arising from. So life was a lot simpler. Now we have 20 years since the original sequencing of the human genome project. It cost them several billion to do one person, and it took about 10 years to get the results out. Now we can get a full sequence of a person, about 20 to 30,000 genes, in about 2 weeks, and it only costs you several thousand pounds.
Right.
And, you know, people in the States are doing that. They want to know, you know, if I have a risk of cancer, what mutation I have. So that is something that we can achieve. But let me remind you, if you have a 30,000 gene report in front of me, I wouldn't be able to tell you what to do because the vast majority are what we call passenger mutations that doesn't matter. Even if we treat all the mutations, tumor is variable. There may be different cells within the tumor itself that will have different mutations. So the problem with cancer is we're not just dealing with one mutation. We're dealing with a condition with uncontrolled cell growth where what we call cancer is actually not a one cell problem. It's the systemic problem,
right?
Because we're talking about advanced cancer. If you're looking at early cancer, if you cut all the cells out, you wouldn't worry anymore. You've managed to remove all of it. But what we are dealing with is a condition where it's a bit like uncontrolled COVID. It has already spread throughout the system with a variety of different strains. And just targeting one mutation like the spike proteins, even with the best vaccines in the world, it's not 100% the virus somehow managed to escape it.
Of course.
And so we would say, well, we could live with cancer, just like we could live with COVID, but we have to accept there will be some young patients where it's an absolute disaster because they do poorly and we don't understand why. Or it could be that we will try everything. And for example, President Trump, which we can see is overweight, he's older, and yet he did very well. So we may have to think about how we use the resources. Now, President Trump, if he wasn't president, might not get the best treatment, but he did get the best treatment, and he did reasonably well. He survived COVID. So I'm not being pro or anti vaccines. I'm not being controversial. I'm just saying we as a society are going to have to make difficult decisions in how resources will be utilized. We cannot have a society where we are dictated by billionaires who can have all the resources in the world, and then the vast majority of people in the rest of the world doesn't even have a vaccine. So it is about a bit like how we manage COVID, a bit about how we're going to manage cancers, how we're going to use personalized medicine.
Yeah, well, cancer is, of course, a pandemic, really. It's just that it's not talked about every day in the news like COVID is. With one in two of us going to get cancer in our lifetime, it's absolutely out of control. And it's still getting worse, of course. Very interesting. The thing that interests me about the whole exploration is that there seemed to me no doubt about it that when they were setting out to find about all these mutations, that they definitely felt they were going to find a mutation that caused kidney cancer, and that once they found that one, they were going to fix it, and that would be the end of kidney cancer. It was going to be so simple, really. And that's really not where it's arrived, is it? And it feels like we've got this incredible technology which doesn't do what it was hoped to do, but that doesn't mean it's useless, actually. It's finding, we've got the technology. Well, what's it good for? And it does seem that it is good for some quite specific things. Finding out about individuals, we actually know the difference. Why the same substance has a completely different effect on different people, which is quite a key to our health, I think.
It's difficult. We are only beginning to scratch the surface of this genetic question.
Yeah.
If you have, let's say, cystic fibrosis, it's a one gene problem.
Okay.
They have an expensive gene therapy. They can inoculate you and replace your gene and sort of cure your cystic fibrosis. Obviously, there's a problem. If you trigger cancers, there's a small chance of that treatment actually triggering cancer because it uses a virus to inject the genetic material into your cells. There are certain pediatric conditions with single gene flaws where there's technology, the CRISPR technology can actually replace that gene.
Okay.
And then the patient's condition is actually cured forever.
Mm. Right, amazing.
And those treatments are several million pounds per patient, but it's probably worth it because you are so rare.
Yeah,
it's a cure, and you have a whole life in front of you.
Mm.
One of the problems that you say, why is cancer not talked about, is the vast majority is older. And so even if you treat the cancer and manage to get rid of the cancer, it may not be the cancer that gets them.
Right.
The other problem is because it's so common, the people that controls the budget, the treasury, the insurance payers, will start to think, well, if I have to treat one in two with all these expensive $1 million treatments,
right.
We cannot afford it. That's the problem. So we have to find a way to select patients, not saying ageism or not saying classism, I'm not saying discriminatory practices, but we are already by default into it. People who can afford to do genetic sequencing versus people who can't afford to do genetic sequencing. It is going to come. And NHS hopefully will have some of the solution, but their solution will take time. It will be lag time, as you already mentioned. NHS requires a higher burden of evidence than a system that is not meant to be a universal payer. It's a different way of counting for costs.
Yes. So let me just ask you, here I am, somebody with cancer, and I've had a diagnosis, I've been given a proposed treatment plan, they want to give me chemotherapy for a year and two courses of radiotherapy, and it's straight off the computer, you just press the button for that kind of cancer, out it comes. Now, am I better off going and having some gene testing at this point or not, given that there are swings and roundabouts, there are pluses and minuses to this. Is this a good idea for me to do this thing?
So to answer to that is, it depends. If we used to think, before the era of CT scan, we used to give chemo without needing a CT scan.
Right.
But once the CT scan was done and see, yes, the tumor has already spread, it hasn't spread, we start to stratify, we start to choose patients who needs chemo. If you have lymph node disease or if it's spreading, maybe we should need to give you chemo. So I think it's only part of the testing regime that we should implement routinely. I think if you ask me in 5 years, yes, the answer is everybody will end up doing it. We cannot imagine treating lung cancer nowadays without doing the mutation. So it's already being done in certain cancer types. So right. In lung cancer, they are already testing for multiple genes. For ovarian cancer, you similarly will test for BRCA mutation or test for homologous recombination HRD test. What they're doing is a single test at once. So they need a bigger sample and they cut blocks out to do each individual test. The cons with that approach is you soon run out of tissue. And I think it's a bit more costly because when you're doing one test at a time, let's say it charged a certain amount, a much cheaper amount than doing it all packaged as one.
Yeah.
But when you add all the tests up, you actually spend more in terms of biopsying, repeat biopsy, and then getting patients in for complications of biopsy and time wasted waiting for results. Actually, it costs more, but it's hard when the cost in the NHS is not accounted by one body where all this cost goes to different departments.
Right.
It's hard to change. It's hard to quantify it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm interested to hear that, you know, this is routinely being used in some situations in cancer. Okay, well, look, there's one thing I read about when I was looking around the internet about you, which I was very interested to ask you about. I think you've already alluded to it earlier on, which is this Molecular Diagnostics Innovation Partnership. Now, you were talking about everybody working together. This is, I think, a structured way of that happening. I'd really like to hear you tell us a bit more about that, particularly because I was heartened to see that included in the people who are going to work together were patients, which is quite often not the case. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about that.
So the idea for having a what we call multidisciplinary team is actually very common in the oncology world of UK. Having pathologists involved, radiologists, surgeon, oncologists, specialist nurses, and usually getting a patient representative is actually not that common around the world. In the States, you don't have this concept. In Asia, this is not normal. You have one oncologist, they do everything and they interpret all the tests for you. But in the UK, we have evolved down the line of working together, surgeons talking to oncologists, oncologists talking to radiologists, and this is actually derived from the NHS. This is actually an NHS directive based on previous failing. You know, people were in silos. Just because I learned and worked and trained in the UK, the idea of working together, whether it's in genomics medicine or whether it's diagnostic medicine or whether it is treating cancer, it all comes into it. It all means opening your mind, opening your ears and listening and collaborating and learning from each other. So what we're bringing into this is that the genomics medicine, it is being derived and being done by geneticists and lab and scientists where they sit in their little silo in the lab, whereupon I have the patient in front of me and I have to explain the findings to the patient. So by bridging everybody, sitting them all down in one room, getting them to explain what your tests mean and how important it is, as a clinician, as an oncologist, I give them context. I know that what you sample, what you have in your hand in the lab is only part of the puzzle. You haven't got the whole tumor. You haven't got all the cells. You have a sample of the cell. So what they say, oh, you have to use this drug or that drug, you have to use your clinician's head and think, hang on, if I just treat that mutation, what about the cells that we haven't sampled? So you have to think what is in front of you and what is not visible. So, and then ultimately, you have to put the suggestion based on all the scientific best ideas in front of you, the patient. You say, look, you could use a therapy which probably will kill any fast dividing cell unless they have a mutation that blocks the cancer, the chemotherapy. Or you take the guidance from the scientific team based on the biopsy, that the limited biopsy you've taken that suggests you may have certain mutation. Your main hope is that the mutation is what we call a driver mutation, which means it is present in every single cell.
Right.
And it is driving the growth of the cell.
Okay.
A bit like the spike protein in the coronavirus. So if you target that, you have a great chance of stopping the damage to your body.
Right.
But if you are treating a random passenger mutation, which doesn't affect the cancer, then the harm is that you are actually not touching the cancer. What you're treating is just part of the fraction of the cell in the patient.
There's no way of differentiating between these two types at present then. You can't tell which is the driver.
We do know, and the concept comes from a New England Journal paper actually done in the UK. Roy Marston did it in 2012. and the paper is freely available. And they actually biopsy every site of tumor. So they biopsy the primary for multivirus. They biopsy different metastases. And what they call driver mutation is present in every area.
Right.
Whereupon the passenger mutation could branch off in different areas. And actually treating the branches is not going to affect the main areas.
Right. So that's the hallmark, is that wherever you look, you find it.
Correct. So the key thing is, if you find that kind of mutation, you find something that is present everywhere, then you've got a greater chance of having some success.
Mm.
But it's not 100%. Even in COVID, we know it's not 100%.
Right. So that's, so that's not a complete insurance then that a treatment is going to work. Mm, interesting. Would these things that start off seeming like a straightforward idea only get more complicated the further you look, don't they? The closer you zoom in on things, the more complex they are.
In a way, I'm very grateful that, well, I'm not grateful for having COVID pandemic, but it is helpful to an oncologist to explain to people, and it makes sense. But just looking at the COVID, the fact that we have had 4 or 5 different strains of the COVID tells you that, just like cancer, the virus is actually dividing and mutating all the time. And it branches off with dead ends, and it branches off with very aggressive ends that will replace the original strain. So it is actually reflective of, you know, imagine the world, the earth is the healed patient, and the viruses are different strains of cancer cells that completely replaces the whole infection.
It's true. It's a public education. We all know a lot more than we used to after this pandemic. Look, really interesting talk. Thanks so much, Cheng. We're going to have to bring it to an end, unfortunately, but I think we could talk a lot more. There's so much to talk about with this subject, but it's a kind of brave new world we've got here, which at the moment it seems like we're struggling to find out, well, what use is this? How do we use it? Can we fit it into the systems we got? How does it relate to the tools we've got to treat cancer? So many questions, but it does feel that there's a lot of potential there nonetheless already. And in a way, maybe we're not exploiting the potential we've already found that it has.
I hope that we can prove that wrong, because nowadays with the COVID pandemic, we are all talking about mutation, we're talking about resistance, we're talking about how to target mutation resistant strain. So hopefully we are learning from the COVID and making the best use of it in other fields of medicine.
Right. Yeah, so maybe it will bring about change there. Yeah, certainly brought about plenty of other changes this pandemic. So that's an interesting new area I hadn't thought about, but maybe it will. Okay, well, look, thank you very much indeed, Cheng. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Robin. Brave new world.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it'll be very interesting to find out what uses genomics will end up being put to in cancer care and how much impact they will have on our ability to control cancer. If you enjoy listening to the Yes Live show, you might also want to check out the Cancer Talk podcast that I co-host with NHS oncologist Dr. Penny Kekayoglu, looking to build bridges between the worlds of conventional cancer care and complementary and lifestyle medicine. Find full details of Cancer Talk on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. Just click the link that's on the homepage. Thanks very much for listening today. I look forward to introducing another guest and another topic from Integrative Oncology to you next week in the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.